We are.
I think we're live.
I think we're live. And we're live.
All right, then welcome to the Presidio Bitcoin Jam. Here we go.
Here we go. We're trying some new tools today. So we're improvising, so to speak. Hopefully you guys can all see us.
Yeah, I'm back in the remote studio, so I'm kind of the cause of all the problems, I think. We're still ironing out some of the technical details, but
we got to figure it out for the long term.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah. I see us live on X. Right. So I think it's working.
Steve has confirmed. We're good to go.
Cool. Great job by our producer, Alex, to get us going.
Let's get it.
And we got we're a little late. Apologies, but we have a great show. We have like 50 things we want to talk about.
A million things.
Let's get to it.
Yeah. Let's get to it.
And I think you were starting with women's NBA. Were you going to tell us about your experience at the WNBA?
Yes, Steve, please.
I can. And we can talk about NBA as well.
Yeah, but, yeah.
Yeah, so I went to the Golden State Valkyries game last night against Indiana Fever. I was sporting my Caitlin Clark Indiana Fever jersey.
All right.
She grew up like 10 miles from where I grew up in Iowa.
Oh, okay.
So, wow, so I followed her since she's like seventh grade.
I thought Steve was a bandwagoner.
I'm not a bandwagoner. No, no,
no.
Yeah.
When Brock Purdy, Tyrese Hamilton, Caitlin Clark, I'm not a bandwagon fan. I've been fans of them for like 10 years.
Iowa forever.
Iowa State. She, though, is an Iowa Hawkeye, which I usually cannot root for any Iowa Hawkeye, but she is so incredible that I suck it up and root for a Hawkeye.
Yeah.
Golden State it's a brand new team in the league this year, new franchise. And I was surprised by many things. So I went to the game last night.
Yeah.
First time I'd seen her in person. First of all, there were an insane number of people there. And I learned that Golden State sells out every women's NBA game.
Surprised to hear
not
that.
Not 18,000 people a game. They play in the Chase Center where the Warriors play.
And these seats, by the way.
Is that a newer phenomenon? Like, did that just start happening this year? Or is that...
Women's NBA has not been popular historically.
Exactly.
It's been a difficult product to watch, and they lose money. That it's not been a good product. Caitlin Clark has brought like insane levels of, it's kind of like a Larry Bird, Magic Johnson, or Michael Jordan moment that from the 80s in the NBA. But the Golden State Valkyries, they didn't just have a sellout for Caitlin Clark. They've sold out every game. 18,000 people. They lead the league in attendance. And it wasn't just a lot of people there. The energy there was as good as a Warriors game.
That's awesome.
It was, and it got loud. I was shocked. It got really, really loud.
Yeah. Without doxing Steve here, like these cheap seats, to be clear, are not cheap. Like I was like, oh, are these like super budget discount seats to fill? Like, no, I mean, good for the WNBA. I'm surprised, but that's crazy.
I didn't, courtside tickets were $5,000 a seat. I did not have a courtside ticket, but I did have a good ticket. And I paid more than I have for almost any ticket I've ever purchased, except for like NBA Finals and World Series.
That's crazy. Yeah.
But it was a good night, although Caitlin Clark went 0-7 from 3, which she hasn't done for like ever. and the home team won, which is good for the home team crowd.
Yeah.
But so that was a good experience.
Yeah.
And then I think you had some NBA news.
Since we are talking basketball, as many of you guys know, I got to always do it for the M, you know what I'm saying, Memphis. And, you know, I was shocked that Steve had not heard this, being an NBA fan, but I got to give a shout out to our GM. In some ways, it's kind of weird. I love college basketball more, actually watching the games. You know, I watch NBA games, but it's kind of boring, but, you know, because they're not trying as hard as in college. But what I really love, and I think this kind of checks out with what I love about, you know, doing investing and in and around Bitcoin as well, is I love the sort of like in the college, the recruiting and the team building. And then in the NBA, the sort of like the role of the GM to try and figure out like, all right, how do you get like the best position? Kind of like your name suggests, Moneyball, right? Like, how do you find someone on the cheap that's going to absolutely outperform? And I got to give a shout out to our GM. I thought he'd made some horrible trades in the last couple of years. Really good drafting though. But Desmond Bane for 4 first round picks to the Magic and a first round swap. I mean, it's crazy when you see Luka Doncic out here getting traded for 1 first. Man, if I was a Dallas fan, I would be livid, pissed beyond all control. As a Memphis fan, I like Dez. He's been an incredible shooter for us. But, you know, the man has no all-stars. He's solid. He's not huge, not a great defender. 4 firsts in a swap? Like, damn.
I don't get it.
Yeah.
I don't
get it either.
I don't know. Why did the Magic do that?
I think they think that, you know, their team is like a really good shooter away from competing. I think that's kind of crazy. Maybe they'll get to the second round. with Dez. I mean, he's good. Like, he's a very good player. Like, I'm sad to see him go. But for four first, it reminds me, you remember that NFL player where he got traded and he looks up and he goes, damn, if I knew I was going to go for that, I would trade me. That's the way I felt with this trade. So,
got it.
What do you think, DK?
All right. I've got no ball contributions here. As you guys
sports.
Know. I have nothing to do but maybe guide us into the topic of Bitcoin.
Oh, right.
Let's go straight to, like,
I mean, it's a heavy
duty.
It's an orange ball and an orange basketball. And
there
an
you
orange.
Go.
That's a good
all
segue,
right.
DK. I'm impressed. Yeah.
That's why we have a skilled
mod.
Segwayer.
Yeah. All right, Steve, you want to hit us with something heavy.
Segues.
We're going to go from, like, this light basketball talk to something heavy duty, Stratum V2.
Oh.
Which a lot
Whoa.
Of audience.
Whoa, that's
smooth
quite the
transition. Smooth.
Who knows?
Can we get a little on the builder stuff? Because I feel like I have been involved in the groups a little bit, but I haven't necessarily followed all the play-by-play. But I feel like the builders movement, the B product, B builders.
Oh yeah, yeah. Let's go.
I don't even know really what we settled on for the name. Apologies, but it feels like now that's creating a movement, kind of sparked from our discussions here that are now happening in multiple cities and stuff. So can we just do, like, what's the update there?
Because yeah, there's an update. So I forget if it was 1 or 2 weeks ago. It must have been 2 weeks ago on the show.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget the context of what we were even talking about, but then all of a sudden I said, why don't we have a monthly meetup like BitDevs, which is a technical focus one, but more on design, product, applications.
Business.
And all of us were like, of course. And then everyone we shared it with since then is like, of course. So it's like one of those, like, why does this not already exist? This should have been done a long time ago, but let's do it now, right? So we went through a naming exercise and went through a few iterations, landed on Builder with the B being the Bitcoin symbol B. Mm-hmm. So if you're speaking it, you can say it Bitcoin Builder. Or Builder for short, but depending on whether you need to emphasize the Bitcoin. But visually, it's just the word Builder with the Bitcoin symbol B. We now have an X account, a GitHub account, so we're official. Right. We're doing our first one next Thursday, so in 6 days at Presidio Bitcoin. And as DK alluded to, there's already going to be one in Miami as well. I think independent from us, some folks in Miami were having similar thinking and creating a new meetup, and they had a different name in mind. But they like the name Builder, so they're going to adopt Builder, and they forked our GitHub repo, and so we're going to collaborate with them.
Sick.
This will be a monthly meetup, just like BitDevs. There'll be a list of topics that we walk through. Anyone can contribute to these topics, so anyone can submit topics, and we'll also share these topics with Miami and any other city that wants to start one, just so we can, like, help each other out. So I'm super excited for it. We've done some brainstorming about what we want to see in one of these meetups, mm-hmm. and I thought we could talk about it in the show too to add to that. But
yeah,
I mean, there's some, like, potential staples of just, like, news from that past month. I mean, quite similar to this show, actually, right? Yeah. So we can even draw content out of of this show and pick the most interesting topics to discuss instead of just the three of us jamming on it. At one of these meetups, you're going to have, like, 10, 20, maybe 50 people in the audience, and it's a Socratic seminar style. So it's not, even if the three of us are up in front as moderators, we're not dictating the conversation. We, in fact, our role as moderator is to get the audience to participate and share their ideas, their thoughts, ask questions, no questions too stupid. We'll definitely cover a bunch of topics. They could be related to design, product design, vibe coding tools, and any kind of new tools to build, product announcements, or any kind of products that anyone's used or wants to talk about. Also things like legal or regulatory or tax or all those things that could impact products. Hopefully we don't talk about that too much, but if they do impact builders, we want to talk about it. So that's one component, but I think there's a lot of excitement around demos as well. Live demos.
Yeah.
So, like, one concrete demo that I'd like to see happen, and I think we'll do it in the July session. Matt Velez recently vibe coded a Bitcoin tipping app using Lexi as the Bitcoin payment platform. He did it in 14 minutes.
Wow.
A working demo. He'd never used Lexi before.
That's sick.
So like it literally took him 14 minutes. So having him or someone walk through like a less than 15 minute demo showing the prompts, I think would be super valuable for the audience, because I think a lot of people might hear of like DK or Matt or others' exploits with vibe coding, but it's like
exploits. You're a hacker now, vibe hacker.
But you know, actually seeing the prompts is valuable, and some of us have been trying to get VO3 to produce amazing film scenes and stuff, and it can be a struggle initially. It's to make it look super awesome. So I think there's a large appetite for seeing prompts. So we could do that type of demo, but also like one minute demos, just people showing what they've been building. I could imagine weaving in like showcasing a startup each month or something, and maybe they get a 5 minute prezo or something like that. We can, you know, whether it's 3 or 5 or 10 minutes or 1 or 2 or 3 a month. I don't know the right formula, but I think that would be super interesting. And because I expect to attract a lot more people from Silicon Valley to this event, because the other monthly events we have are very technical, very in the weeds.
Yeah.
This one, I think venture capitalists, engineers, executives in Silicon Valley,
product managers,
product managers, designers, they don't even have to be, you know, I'd say they don't even need to self-label themselves Bitcoiners. Yeah. Just simply Bitcoin curious. Frankly, even just vibe coding, building. Just if they're interested in building, I think this would be a good meetup. And then, you know, they'll see how easy it is to add payments.
Yeah.
And it, in fact, maybe that's a good segue. You saw the Carpathy slide deck.
I actually want to mention two things on that. I'm definitely going to talk about that as one of them. But, you know, my hope here is it's going to be two things. One, I think it's going to be a really good exposure point for a lot of existing builders in Silicon Valley, just to realize, you know, I think for so many people, they still think Bitcoin, oh, it's digital gold. Cool. I own some Bitcoin. Great. Now let me go build the stuff I want to build on Ethereum or Solana or whatever the contract chains are. They have no idea that this stuff is even possible. One just like little tidbit before I jump in the Carpathy thing. So yesterday, well, as I told you guys, I actually had two orange peeling stories. I told you one, which is a little bit more delicious because it involves honey. But the first one was that the beauty of San Francisco, I was walking down into the marina and I ran into a fellow Bitcoin venture capitalist, Vikash, who comes and hangs out here sometimes. And he was chilling on a bench with another guy who I won't dox. Sorry, I just doxed you, Vikash. And he is like, I presume, high up at one of these more traditional sort of like treasury type startups, you know, fintech guy, very familiar with fintech, very interested in stable coins. And I think doing a lot with stable coins in his company right now. And a Bitcoiner in the sense that he owns Bitcoin and is like, oh yes, I'm glad I have my digital rock, which will go up in value. We ended up like, I thought we were going to chat for like 5 minutes. Well, I was walking down to swim the bay and we ended up walking for an hour together and chatting. We discussed and I did my best to explain. I just can't help myself. I'm sometimes just like, man, you know, should you really be out here like spreading the gospel? And that, you know, and yeah, that's what ends up happening. And by the end of this thing, we discussed MicroStrategy and the different offerings. We discussed all the different, some of the graduated wallet tech, all the stuff that's happening. And by the end of this, I could just see this man's eyes lit up and he was completely orange pilled. Like, all right, you know, he was asking, I've got 100 units of capital. What do I do with it? And by the end, he was like clearly ready to go all in, I think, which is, you know, not just from the price action, but exciting from the building action. So
what do you think he found most compelling, or what was there a certain idea that you shared that he kind of glommed onto or got deeper with, or what sort of helped him get it?
I think there were three things. One was I just did my best, as we've done on the show before, to explain the Michael Saylor strategy and just how I think this guy is going God mode, and explaining the like speculative attack on the dollar, and let him ask all the questions he wanted. But by the end of it, it was just very clear. And I also tried to delineate between the Saylor strategy and like the sort of BitConnect potential of some of these other treasury companies. Not all of them. There's some other ones we discussed, which maybe are in better stead. But I think he started to understand like, holy shit, if the treasury market or like just a substantial portion of the bond market gets repriced, like Bitcoin is the thing, nothing else. So that was very powerful. I think a second thing that was very powerful was talking about blocks, the returns. We explained Lightning Network routing. You know, he was kind of like, oh, Lightning Network, kind of heard of that. I thought that thing was dead. That's like a common, super common narrative. When we're explaining that, you know, even if the 10% BTC on BTC yield is too high, you know, even whatever, a couple of percentage points was just like, oh, wow, that's very interesting. And then three, we talked a lot about how, you know, even if stable coins get very popular, Bitcoin can bridge into stable coins. And so whether that's through like actually a Lightning Network bridge to chains like Solana or Tron or wherever these things are running, we talked a lot about Taproot assets, if that's a possibility, Spark, if that's a possibility. I could see his eyes go off and be like, okay, now like stable coins are going to be able to interop with the Bitcoin network. Now we can actually start to build things. Anyways, the giant takeaway from that whole conversation was he's going to come to Builder. So I think you're going to see so many of these dudes, like the hackers themselves, who are going to build new stuff, which is fucking awesome. But you're also going to see people that are execs at all these other companies that literally just don't know. It's not that they're anti-Bitcoin. They just have no idea that Bitcoin is useful.
Yep. One thing to add to that too. An idea that I heard, we're planning a Bitcoin design week in September at Presidio Bitcoin. And one of the ideas for that week, we want to attract Silicon Valley designers to that. So on one of the days, we're likely going to do design sprints on imagining or reimagining Silicon Valley products, big tech products.
I love that.
With Bitcoin integrated. So whether
that's good.
You know, whether it be Facebook or Google or, you know, Instacart or you name your favorite Silicon Valley tech startup, but reimagine it with Bitcoin. And I think that I'm really excited to see the results for that, because I think with the emergence of vibe coding, we'll have not only like Figma mocks, but we'll have
products.
We'll actually have like working applications, and you don't need access to the corporation's code base to have it look like that. I mean, Miles Suter already proved that with the wallet he vibe coded. He just told the LLM, make it look like Cash App, and it made it look like Cash App, right? So you could do the same, whether it's Google Docs or whatever your tech product you want to like reimagine with Bitcoin, you can do that. So I'm very excited about that. But relating it back to the monthly meetup, the Builder meetup, it would be great to either demonstrate those there or somehow weave that into the monthly meetup. And then David, who's actually an ex Instacart engineer, he's excited for this meetup and is volunteering to help out as well. And an idea he had is to get people from Silicon Valley who are Bitcoiners, who are advocates within their company, who have tried to champion Bitcoin within their company and obviously failed, but then like share those stories. What barrier did they hit?
Yeah, I love that.
Right. And I think that those would be good stories to tell at the meetup if they can be told. In fact, I reached out to someone I know who was at Intuit and did exactly that. I mean, he tried and failed. So hearing those stories would be valuable. And then someone's going to crack a nut and actually like succeed. So that would be an incredible case study to share on like, hey, here's how I achieved that. Share it with others and then they'll be able to do that in other companies.
And you know what I think the nut actually may be? So I love this idea of sharing knowledge and sort of having a support group for Bitcoiners in big companies, but people that at least are somewhat curious, then I imagine the Bitcoiners in those companies will just end up bringing them to Builder. Because, I mean, I like, DK, you had an investor friend in here a couple weeks ago, and he said something that I've kind of like, it stuck with me. He made the point that he was talking about in the context of AI, but I think it's true for anyone. Like anyone that's done at least 100 hours of research on Bitcoin is not a Bitcoiner. I've never met. I mean, I'm sure the internet will find some examples, but let's say the vast majority of people that commit to 100 hours of research are going to walk away being like, oh yeah, this Bitcoin thing is legit. And his point on that as an aside, I thought was interesting, is that AI will come to a similar conclusion. So interesting. But I think that the more
we can do the 100 hours of work in like a few seconds.
In a couple of milliseconds. But the more we get people that are, you know, at least not super hostile, and even if they are hostile, like coming and being around so many people that are like completely not nut jobs, like, you know, I think very sensible. Perhaps I'm overrating our level of sanity here. But I think it's going to go a very long way. And I could see this becoming like a church.
And but also, go ahead, DK.
Yeah, I was going to say, I know these aren't, I think, Silicon Valley companies. They're in the cast of Silicon Valley companies, but they may be located elsewhere. But I thought I heard, was it this week, that I want to say maybe Klarna and or Shopify announced something around accepting some sort of digital or crypto Bitcoin payments? Do either of those, maybe they're stablecoin stuff? I think it was stablecoin. Do you remember seeing or hearing anything about that?
Yeah, I think it was stablecoins.
Stablecoins. Because I think that's part of the thing is like, it's hard for me to imagine exactly how Google Maps should be reimagined with stablecoins or Bitcoin or something. Like maybe you could make a case, and I hope people invent cool things you can do with that. But I think when you have like direct commerce flows like you have in Klarna or Shopify, they're very natural places to start to include stablecoins. And I think stablecoins one hop away from Bitcoin. So there's already kind of examples emerging.
Well, and just to be clear, and we should talk about the stablecoin Bitcoin thing too. I know that's on the agenda for today. But I think that coming back to vibe coding for a minute, like actually the thing I'm most excited about is, you know, it's cool to reimagine the existing products with Bitcoin or stablecoins or whatever you want in there. I'm much more excited about the new products. So as an example, you say, I can't imagine Google Maps with Bitcoin payments or stablecoin payments, but like imagine Waze, but incentivized, right? Like how dope is that going to be where it's like, no, I need new data collection in real time and I'll pay you for it. Like, I mean, it's a brand new primitive when you can pay people and agents to do things in real time, and it's going to be huge. Coming back on the vibe coding thing, because I think this relates into your point, the second sort of aim I think we should have for the builder meetup, besides just, okay, we're going to orange pill, and I noticed that somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but the you know, welcome Silicon Valley into the cult, so to speak. But I think the second thing that I'm really excited about is, and I think this should be our mission. I don't know if we are there yet today. I think we can get there. But forget, you know, okay, I don't agree. I haven't done my 100 hours of research. I don't necessarily agree with the ideology, whatever you want to say. Can using open protocols like Bitcoin, Lightning Network, and Nostr be the easiest way to vibe code a working app? Full stop. And what inspired me on this was what we discussed a little bit in the chat, and what you were bringing up was Andre Karpathy gave a talk this week that's been making the rounds on Twitter at YC Startup School. And the talk is good. It's a 40-minute talk. Karpathy, for those who don't know, you know, was early, I think, founding member at OpenAI, led AI research at Tesla, like very legit dude. He coined the term vibe coding in February, which is crazy that it's already a mainstream meme. It's like 3 months, 4 months in. So that's kind of wild, just showing how fast things are going. But, you know, he says a lot of interesting things in this talk. And I mean, we could talk about many of them. One is he says, you know, see where my head is at, vibe coding. Or AI in general has elements of utilities. So he compares it to electricity. And, you know, my view on this is, yes, everything in fact is just electricity or power, including Bitcoin, including anything that uses GPUs or cycles. So that's kind of interesting. And he's comparing like how utilities get funded and, you know, making some comparisons to building these new supermodels and the upfront costs and how you amortize that over use case, you know, with the inference at the edge. That's interesting. You know, he brings up that in some ways, they're similar to chip fabs, again, with this like giant upfront cost and sort of the trade secrets that are put in there. But then he starts mentioning how they're more similar to things like operating systems, which it's interesting because you can start to see a lot of parallels between the like closed, okay, we've got, you know, Apple's iOS or, you know, whatever, macOS. We've got, you know, the Google Android, which is kind of open source, and then full open source Linux. And so sort of making some comparisons there. All that's very interesting. But the thing that stuck with me the most was one slide. And I don't think many people have commented on this, but it was a slide he shared before where he was like, okay, when I vibe code, and it's worth noting that like for like real production code, he's more bullish on something like using Cursor, where you can use elements of vibe coding, but also like easily shift into like software engineering mode when you need to fix things. That's like definitely where we are today. But the full vibe coding in the style of a DK or MapLS, he was basically saying that's awesome for really quick prototyping. The challenge he mentioned though is like, imagine I just like, okay, I say a couple of words, maybe go back and forth for 10 minutes and boom, I've got this sick app. The challenge he was saying is that, you know, maybe it takes whatever, 20 minutes to get the prototype up and running and it's sick, but it took a week plus of additional work to actually get it functioning on the web as a functional app. And the reason is for what he's calling all the kind of like DevOps. And this is like just the pain in the ass stuff that no one wants to deal with. For example, the two biggest ones that stood out to me were authentication. And this was like his biggest frustration face on the slide. How do I get, you know, users to authenticate into my app, and I guess potentially the agents to authenticate with other agents. There's a whole long history of like OAuth and like how that became super centralized, and you need the permission of basically four or five servers run by Twitter X, Facebook, Google, I guess Apple, a few other companies. And like, if you don't have that, like authentication is a giant headache. So that's one giant.
But you can do authentication while you're vibe coding with the existing OAuth providers if you want, right?
Is he
making the point that there's some challenge with that, or that he wants a new type of authentication?
So he didn't mention that specifically. It was on the slide. All I know is it had his biggest frustration point. So we'd have to like follow up and see exactly where it was. It could have been for the agents as well. Like, how does an agent sort of authenticate? Mm-hmm. But even still, I don't know. Like, when you vibe code and you want to do authentication, how easy is it to hook into like the Twitter X login or Google login? Because my understanding is it's still complicated.
I've added Google authentication to vibe coded stuff. It is, I mean, you feel more like you're doing software engineering than you feel like you're just like floating on air. Like, a lot of vibe coding is kind of pitched.
Yeah.
You know, you have to go in and create a developer account and create like permissions and, you know, have a key for that particular application that you're going to use for your user to authenticate. So it's like a little bit of, you know, actual more, you know, software engineering like work.
How much permission do you need from Google? Like, how much permission do you need from Google? Like, is it something that's really easy to do, or like, do you have to get like, oh, this is an app, we're okay?
No, it's very easy. It's the same way you would do it if you were just writing the code yourself. You just don't have to write the code yourself. You have the LLM write the code. Okay. But it's not hard to do.
So my guess then is that his frustration point was less that, although that does sound somewhat frustrating, but more for the agents themselves. So like, how does an agent authenticate into an app? So if that's the point, then how does an agent authenticate into an app, which the OAuth stuff, just there is no standard for that yet. And I think that's a huge area of opportunity, is like OAuth for agents. The other one that stood out to me on that, and let's assume he was talking about agents here then, is payments. He was basically like, I want to get payments up and running, and like Stripe, it's got some stuff for agents, but not really. And so all that to say, and there's other stuff on there as well.
Like Vercel deployments, Flux API keys, mm-hmm. domain names.
Yeah, domain names.
Yeah. Interesting.
So the kind of challenge I would issue to us as, I guess, a builder community is, can we get to a point where open protocols like Nostr for authentication, Bitcoin, Lightning, and whatever else, Spark, Cashew, whatever on the edge for payments, DK's top secret project for DNS or domains, like, can we get to a world where our open stack, it's not that people use it because they're in the cult, they use it because it's just so fucking easy that I can vibe code without having to be a DevOps guy?
Yep. I totally agree with that. That's the way we should be framing it and aiming for. And hopefully it's true.
Yeah, hopefully it's true. We'll find out.
Hopefully we demonstrate that. But which is why I just wanted to reiterate the point, this builder meetup, we wanted to be extremely welcoming to Silicon Valley folks, at least the one at Presidio Bitcoin. And I think you don't have to be a Bitcoiner to enjoy this and be part of it. DK's made the point for many, many years now that, like, at least with games, but I think we could broaden this to any application, that instead of thinking about, oh, let's build a great Bitcoin game or Bitcoin application, let's just build a great game that happens to have Bitcoin payments integrated.
Yeah.
And I think that's the mental shift. That's going to be the focus for this meetup. And so I think anyone in Silicon Valley should enjoy this.
I have a question about the meetup. That I'll just kind of real time test a little bit of how somebody might go about this. So Max called my naming project top secret. It's actually not top secret at all. I'm happy to share it with anybody who's interested.
It was tongue in cheek.
But I haven't shared it yet because I've mostly been kind of gathering feedback from just some friends who I think have good feedback on it. But it feels like the kind of thing I would like to get more feedback on. So is there? But I don't have like a demo to share. It's more like a proposal or a kind of a philosophy for how to do decentralized naming. So would the builders forum be like a good place to sort of either present some of the ideas, give some feedback, you know, sort of galvanize some consensus around what is this a good approach? Are there others we should consider? How would that fit in?
I think yes. And maybe there's one requirement, so we can talk about that. that the person who wants that feedback, you need to publish something ahead of time. Because then it would be a natural thing to be added to the topic list. And then anyone ahead of time, who certainly the moderators, but anyone attending is free. They'll see that in the list ahead of time, and they're free to read up on it, be it 30 seconds or 30 minutes to research it. And then that'll bring a lot better questions and ideas. So I think that would be maybe a requirement versus just sort of like real-time sharing thoughts.
I like that.
Cool. So basically publish like a proposal to say like a GitHub page or somewhere. And then that could be linked with the agenda, and then people could read it and engage to whatever extent they're interested.
Yeah.
Even better if it's a Vibecoded app, so I can buy my first name.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking about that. I haven't revisited that with the Vibecoding world yet. So does anybody run a Bitcoin node as an MCP?
Actually, just yesterday, Albi announced their first MCP server, which I think does that.
Oh, cool. What exactly? Yeah, can you tell more about the announcement? Because I didn't catch it.
I believe it is. Actually, I don't feel like I can probably represent it. Maybe against you.
No, I mean, I think that is the announcement.
Yeah. I mean, you can go to their, you know, Twitter and Oscar to find more, but I think that is it.
But they're running a node, and then you're using like Albi to access the node that they're running, and you're sort of like trusting them for this use case.
Oh, no.
Is that right?
I think this was more of a generalized for payments. So I think, if you wanted to plug in and have agents using Bitcoin for payments, the MCP server is supposed to be an easy way to like just add payments to your agent, I think. But we'd have to check that. I don't think it's like, oh, I want to access the node to like be able to query some information or something.
Okay. I was wondering because I spent a lot of time trying to set up a node to be able to build like an indexer around the node to be able to understand what information is flowing through the node so that I can kind of do a better job of prototyping this proposal for the name stuff. But if there were an MCP that I could use, that would be like a useful tool.
Yeah.
It sounds like it's maybe it is part of that or not really.
Check Albi. If it's not there, maybe someone listening to the show will build it. But I get your point. It's a good idea. One thing I want to mention for the meetup. So I think coming back to that idea that we have a simple goal. How is Bitcoin Noster, our open protocol stack, the easiest protocol stack to Vibecode with? It would be very interesting to me, and maybe Matt's the right person to do this when he does his sort of demo of how he built his Bitcoin tipping app. It'd be really cool to me, I think, to see like contrast. Like, hey, here's me trying to like Vibecode this app, Bitcoin Noster. I got it done in 14 minutes. Here's me try to Vibecode it with traditional authentication, traditional payment rails. Like, what are the roadblocks I run into? I think right. that comparison, that A-B test would be really valuable.
100% agree. And he started to do that, not exactly what you're saying, but he tried to use Spark as well.
Yeah.
And he did, using Spark was harder to Vibecode. Hmm. So I think there's going to be, I fully expect Spark to be able to make whatever adjustments are needed to make it just as easy as Lexi, but highlighting those differences is valuable. And then understanding, is it like trivial to close that gap, or are there fundamental differences?
Yep.
Which is getting to your point. If we compare, stablecoin or like traditional fiat mm-hmm. rails, stablecoins and Bitcoin, compare all three.
Yeah.
See what the gaps are and see if they're fundamental or not.
Yeah.
And that might highlight where stablecoins can shine and where Bitcoin can shine.
Totally. Well, one other thing I just want to mention that kind of came out of this for the Carpathy talk a little bit, because he framed the talk as software 3.0. So software 1.0 is like, you know, old school Discord coding, I believe the kids are calling it, like actually typing things. The second was like the models themselves. We argued that like GitHub was like the repository for 1.0, Hugging Face for all the models, which is like training the weights, 2.0. 3.0 is this Vibecoding thing, which, by the way, seems like a huge opportunity. Maybe it's going to be Replit. They're out in front, or maybe a Bitcoin Noster Lightning sort of Vibecoding platform if that ends up being the protocol stack. But I think one other major takeaway I had from this, which was kind of reinforced, I mean, I think about this a lot in terms of my own like sort of portfolio, but like from the hackathon as well, is, you know, you made this point with Lightspark, and they have a phenomenal team. And so they're following this stuff closely. I'm extremely confident they'll be able to have incredible vibe coding tools probably right after this pod. But as I think about in general, like, you know, companies that got started in the old world, unless you have like some moat, which could be hardware, it could be regulatory, like a license, it could be whatever. But like, I almost think it's a really important time for founders. Like, maybe you have some traction with your product or whatever, but to kind of just like take a step back, because the sands are shifting so quickly that what kind of made sense for your roadmap a year ago, and DK, I know we discussed this a little bit in the context of certain startups that we work with when we were in Miami, but like, things are shifting so quickly that it's possible that those who just jump out and are like exploring the edge of what's possible with Bitcoin, Lightning, Noster, and vibe coding could just leapfrog really good legacy products and teams quickly. And so I'm really encouraged to see, you know, teams like Albi that are like literally releasing vibe coding stuff every day now. That's exciting to me. Pablo, obviously, all the stuff he's doing with 10X. Artur's been doing a lot with vibe coding. Like, some of these founders that are really embracing it. I would like, with the grain of salt that I'm not a good vibe coder myself, so, you know, take it for what it's worth. I'm a talking head here. But I would strongly encourage founders and people that are hacking to like take a step back and like imagine if you were starting from a blank slate today with nothing, what would you be doing? Because I think it's one of those moments where you could like get trapped in a local minimum very easily instead of seeing, a local maximum instead of seeing like what's the real potential right now.
Agreed.
Yeah, and I think the economics of how software used to work is so vastly different from like how it works now going forward, that like the things you would value are just very different. Like, it used to be that you'd value a big code base that has a lot of integrations and serves a lot of use cases. Whereas today you might actually say, I actually value a code base that's smaller and more focused and is interoperable or composable with other pieces. And those other pieces are probably going to be built by other people. But just sort of thinking about the insane leverage that an individual has to build anything. Even, you know, I saw some maybe it was a tweet that somebody was writing about. I think somebody was complaining about the cost of DocuSign, you know, document signing subscription software. And somebody was like, oh, I'll just make a better DocuSign, like, you know, kind of vibe coding weekend project. Immediately had like thousands of people sign up, fully end-to-end, did everything that you needed a document signer to do. And I think DocuSign or whoever, maybe Adobe or somebody owns them, and like ended up suing him for IP stuff.
Seriously?
Because they had nothing else. They were just like, oh, you're using our processes or something.
It's like the Metallica Napster of our generation. Well,
it just highlights how threatening this stuff is, because you can actually build these entire projects that I think DocuSign, last I looked, I think it was like a $20 billion company. It's like a very, very huge. And like, you can do a weekend project, and actually, if you've got thousands of people, you can undercut them by, you know, huge amounts and basically only charge for places where you're creating value rather than kind of just the leftover kind of, you know, vestigial, you know, software platforms that have existed before. I think open season on everything. It's like empowerment of the individual to the max.
That's big. It's a good time to be starting Builder.
So anything else on Builder, like any other ideas for what we'd want to discuss or have as part of Builder?
Well, I've never been to a Socratic seminar. I understand that's kind of how I think Bit Devs and Lit Devs and maybe some other kind of forums work. What's the general, like, is it this moderator is calling people up to run things, or they sit at their seat and they host a certain section of the thing? How does it?
A topic list is created ahead of time. It's public, so anyone can suggest topics. And there's usually a progression, like maybe start with some news, look at some stats. For the technical ones, and you get into some maybe some studies or proposals that were technical proposals made, discuss those. Then you get into code bases and look at some PRs that were highlighted that were merged recently. And then the moderator, so anyone can contribute to what those topics are, but the moderators are in charge of saying like, okay, here's what we're going to choose for this week, and make that decision. Then during the actual meetup, the moderators progress the meeting from topic to topic, but they should not be talking the whole time. They open it up to the audience, and they encourage the audience to ask questions. And it, like I said earlier, no questions too dumb. They, you know, obviously anyone in the audience who's has expertise or knowledge or a flee of the moment idea is encouraged to speak up and share. And so it's healthy and productive if as many people as possible are having a say.
Yeah.
And the questions are kind of coming up from pre-reading that people do. There's not like a lot of presentation time as part of that. Is that right?
I would guess most people don't pre-read. They just think on the fly.
And to be clear,
so there's like lightweight amount of kind of topic setting.
I mean, it tends to the better bit does. I mean, there's experts in the room,
exactly.
So they know on the fly like something smart to say or knowledge to drop or to answer people's questions. Cool. The moderators don't have to be the expert. The moderator job is hard, though. I mean, you do need to have a very good breadth and reasonable depth to know how to guide the discussion and when things are off the rails or not with the audience. Mm-hmm. But they're not expected to be the deep experts on every topic. And if they're doing their job right, they get the audience to speak.
And I think that's actually a very good point, which brings up two ideas for me. One is, we used to see each other there back in the day, and like the pre-COVID bit devs was, to your point, someone would bring up, this is back when Leishman was still doing it, who now started River, he was one of the mods, and like would bring up like a PR, and it would just be like, oh, like Greg Maxwell or Peter Woolley or like Lalu, like the guys that wrote the PR would just explain it. And so it was so freaking cool because you would just be like, to your point, like you just literally hear it from the horse's mouth. And that's kind of starting to come back a little bit now, you know, post-COVID with San Francisco. So I think one cool thing we could think about for Builder, particularly our Builder here in SF, is who are those experts we want to hear from? So one thing that would be really cool is like, for example, business models. You know, I think someone commented on one of our pods a few weeks ago. They really liked when we were discussing like, where does value get created? Where does it get captured in the sense of like the Lightning Network routing and stuff? We could certainly talk about some of those things, but also like, for example, stablecoins. Like, how is Bitcoin going to bridge into stablecoins? This is a massive question. No one has the answer. And we're going to have, hopefully in the room, like the people at companies like Bridge or Stripe or whatever, Lightspark, that are really like all in on this and thinking about this. And like, I don't know. I think the more we can lean into what are our experts are like, you know, thinking about like, what would it be like if, Google or Android started accepting Bitcoin payments with NFC, and it's like, oh, well, there's the PM that's working on it. Like, they could talk about it. I think that would be really cool.
Yep. Agreed.
And one more idea I want to throw out on that. And by the way, I know that's also a question of like, should it be like open, like Socratic or Chatham House rules or not? Like, I think that's an interesting discussion as well. Like,
yeah, just so anyone in the audience who doesn't know that, the way BitDevs works is Chatham House rules, which means anything shared during the meetup, it can be shared in public, but you can't attribute it to the person who said it. So if Max gave some alpha or had some controversial opinion or view, that can be shared, but it can't be said that, you know, they can't say that Max said it. So that's one rule. And then also no photos, no videos. So I think we keep those rules. However, carve out, if people are going to give presentations.
Yeah, I agree.
Or demos, not have those rules for those sections, and probably start with that. And then live stream it, record it. And I think, DK, you had suggested that. And I agree, because the people presenting, if you're demoing something you worked on, you probably want as many eyeballs on it as possible. And then it also spreads awareness of the meetup itself and the concept. More people will see that. So I think that's good. But then when we get into the discussion of the topics, probably keep that Chatham House rules and No photos, no videos.
I like that breakdown. One other thing that we could consider trying. So I like the idea of having more demos from startups or hackers or whatever. What if we also tried, and maybe this is too much, I don't know, we'll see, but like every month there's like a lightning round of demos and like it's also like a mini hackathon. So anyone, like the only rule is it just needs to be something new that you've hacked on since the last builder or whatever. But we have some kind of prize. Maybe it's 100,000 Bitcoin. Maybe it's, I don't know, just infinite glory, whatever it is. But it's just, and that can even be audience decided. So it's just like, okay, there's like the main presentation. Maybe like whoever's got something cool to show, show it. And then like real time we vote with maybe like D++ is like lightning voter or something. And there's like a little prize. I think it's just kind of cool because it gives people a little nudge to hack.
Yeah. I like that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I like having like more encouragement and more showcasing of the good work that people are doing, because I think that kind of stuff inspires even more. It, you know, gives people a goal to achieve and then inspires more people out there on the internet to gather on. And I also think part of the magic of Silicon Valley that maybe is lost in other places where it's like more diffuse is that just understanding what kinds of things are at the frontier of work or what things have been tried and haven't worked, and then understand why they haven't worked, and doesn't mean they can't work in the future, but just sort of seeing a little bit of like, what does the frontier thinking look like? Like, what are people actively trying? What are the areas worth exploring or that seem to be on everybody's mind? I think just getting a little bit of that vibe out into the world can help people, you know, in other totally different locations who can't even make the builder meetup, but sort of start to get a little bit into like the thought process of where the frontier may be and sort of, you know, create their own frontier, sure, but just also help people to sort of maybe level up to a kind of a more global view of what kinds of things are interesting or what kinds of tools or techniques are being explored right now.
Well, another comment on leveling up. You mentioned earlier, DK, if you have your namespace idea, you know, can you bring that topic up? And I suggested, well, maybe we have a rule, you have to publish first. Okay, that's one thing. But then someone said, oh, it would be even better if you vibe coded it, right? So I think people will keep leveling up, and we only have so much time in a meetup. And I believe this meetup's going to become quite popular. So we're going to have a lot of people wanting to get their idea, their topic, their app talked about or discussed, right? And so if we have too much demand for the time allotted, well, you know, obviously one way to select is like the quality of the idea, but also the quality of how it's communicated. And everything else being equal, if it's like a vibe-coded, fully functioning application, that's more compelling than UI mocks, which is probably more compelling than a blog post, which is more compelling than nothing at all. So I think that'll be some peer pressure on everyone to do a better job of expressing their ideas too.
Yeah.
Which means if you haven't expressed your ideas, well, get in now, because the bar for what it takes to get featured is going to increase.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And we're going to learn too over time. It's not like we have to get the first one, the first meetup perfect. We're going to do it next Thursday. We're going to learn a lot and iterate. There's going to be the one in Miami I mentioned. They're going to learn and iterate. We'll share ideas. I already chatting with people in Italy. I think like in Italy or Switzerland or like Lugano, I think they're going to maybe do this as well. So, I mean, it's going to spread. I think each city and each meetup can have quite a bit of like, you know, latitude to do their own thing. But hopefully we're all sharing and sharing with each other what we learn and make each meetup better. And they'll be, we'll learn over time. There's like a core set of values or structure or process that really makes sense. And then hopefully that's consistently used throughout, which is kind of how BitDevs works as well.
This is so great. I can't believe we didn't start this years ago. This just seems like it's going to be such a great initiative. Can't wait.
I honestly think this could be like, of all the stuff that's come out of our show or Pursuit of Bitcoin, like this could be the one that really moves the needle the most, and it's going to be fucking big.
Yeah, I do think it'll draw the most people from Silicon Valley to Pursuit of Bitcoin out of anything we've done so far.
By far.
And we'll go from there.
I'm excited.
Cool. All right. Well, in the spirit of moving the topics along as a good Socratic seminar moderator would do, I want to wrap. Let's wrap up the builder section. But I also know that I'll also mention that the titling got a little screwed up. So we don't have any. We're not actually talking about any of the Bitcoin tariff stuff or the stuff that's on the title. We actually had a few other topics that we'd intended to title, and one of them was the Stratum V2 stuff. So I think, why don't we dive into the strategy too? Because I think that's a meaty one, and we're, you know, kind of we started a little late and might end a little late, but we're running through time.
Steve, do you know anything about Stratum V2?
I'm excited to talk about it. So, Alex, are we still able to overlay a website with our setup? I'll start talking about it though to give some context, and if we're able to, we'll show a study. But let me just start really high level, because a lot of the audience might not even know what Stratum V2 is. Bitcoin mining, it's an essential part of Bitcoin. And the way Bitcoin mining has evolved over the years is that there's mining pools and there's miners. And why do mining pools exist? They exist purely for economic reasons. As an individual miner, there's too much risk for the vast majority of miners to try to solo mine. The risk is that you, even if you have like tens of millions of dollars invested in a mining operation, you might go weeks or months without ever finding a block. And you might have to pay the bills. You have to pay employees, electricity bill, etc. So you'd go bankrupt because you're waiting to win this lottery ticket. So hence, pools exist so that you can take many miners, pool them together, win more blocks or mine more blocks more frequently, and then spread the payouts across those miners. So, I mean, this has been the case for over, this has been the case for, you know, over a decade. So this is nothing new to people who understand Bitcoin mining. Now there's a protocol, a software protocol between miners and pools called Stratum. That's been around for over 10 years.
Just to clarify, the thing that you just mentioned is a risk to decentralization, right? Because the miners are acting rationally to pool their risk with others, but then whoever controls the pool becomes a centralized point, and I think a big risk to, you know, the network overall.
That's correct. For multiple reasons. With the current Stratum protocol, Stratum V1, the entities that are choosing the transactions that go into a block are the pools. The miners themselves are just kind of like a dumb participant, literally just calculating SHA-256 hashes over and over and over again. And they're just being told by the pool, here are the transactions that we want to put in this block. Now calculate this magic lottery, you know, this magic number that'll win the lottery. So that's one big problem today within Bitcoin and with the Stratum V1 protocol. There are many other problems with the Stratum V1 protocol. The actual wire protocol itself has no encryption, no authentication, and it's like JSON. It's very inefficient. It's like basically plain text. It's very inefficient protocol between the pool and the miner. Because if you think about what kind of communication has to go back and forth between the two, the pool needs to keep sending jobs to the miner saying, like, you know, anytime the pool is going to be running a Bitcoin Core node, it'll continually be receiving new transactions that people want to mine. And anytime there's a transaction it receives any given second that has a high fee rate, then it's going to want to insert that into the block it's trying to mine. It has to keep, but then the pool needs to keep communicating to all the miners of this updated block template to mine the transactions. So there's a lot of information shared to the miner. Then the miners need to be communicating back to the pool constantly with proof that it's actually mining for that pool. Mm. Because imagine if you're a miner, what prevents you from mining, yeah, telling every pool in existence, oh, I'm mining for you, pay me out right when you win a block? Well, if you tell every pool that, then every block found, you're going to get paid. So there has to be some kind of system there which demonstrate that you're actually mining towards that pool's block template. So Stratum does have a system to solve that. But there's a lot of communication back and forth. So what we're presenting here on the screen is a study that was just released within the past week or so comparing Stratum V2 to Stratum V1 performance. Because unlike Stratum V1, Stratum V2 solves the problems I just mentioned. It adds encryption, it adds authentication, it's a binary protocol, so it's a much more efficient wire protocol. And for decentralization, the most important thing is that it allows miners themselves construct block templates and choose transactions that go into a block.
That's big.
So it's a major, major upgrade. It's been in the works for many years. Spiral has contributed a lot to it, but many mining companies have as well. There's an open source reference implementation for Stratum v2 that's had contribution from Foundry, which is one of the biggest pools in the world, contributions from Brains, which is a really popular mining company, Hut 8, Galaxy, and many other organizations. So it's a true public good. But we're still not seeing adoption of Stratum v2. So this study was put together where benchmark data was created to compare, you know, the performance improvements of the wire protocol. Does it actually matter? Is it just some nerd engineer thing, or does it actually matter to the business economics for the mining pool? And the headline here is that you can improve profitability by 7%.
That's huge.
With Stratum v2. So is that just like made up, or like what's the substance behind that? So we're going to walk through this. So this first graph here, let's see. Can you scroll up a? Yeah.
Are we looking at acceptance rate?
Yeah. So share acceptance rate. Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So yeah, back to the graph. So what is this? Well, as I mentioned earlier, the miner has to keep sending what's called shares to the pool, which is proving that, oh, I'm actually applying hash rate to the block you're telling me to mine. That's what a share is, and that's what this is. Now, so the miner keeps sending this to the pool.
And what is that share? Like, is it a signed message, or like with some private key, or?
It actually has to have some proof of work with it.
Oh, interesting.
So you don't have to achieve the difficulty level of actually mining the block.
Yeah.
Because obviously that means you mined a block. Yeah. But so it's a weaker difficulty, but it proves that the hash rate is applied to the block that pool is set out to do, not another block. Cool. So it's a proof of that.
And how often do you have to keep sending those?
It varies, but think on the order of like 10 to 60 seconds. Like, I think 30 seconds is pretty common, but that's the order of magnitude.
Cool.
Now,
is this related to, you had told us before about this braid pool thing, which I think was some sort of mechanism to try to do similar. Is this part of that, or is this a totally different approach? Or?
Well, what I'm describing is actually what's happened the last 10 years. I mean, Stratum, this is how it's worked for over 10 years. Stratum v2, I'll speak a little bit to the improvements, but it's for the most part a similar mechanism. Braid pool is like very, very different. So we can get into that too if we want, but it's Braid pool is a pretty substantial difference in how it works. I mean, it creates a new blockchain. But yeah, we can get into that if you'd like, but let's focus on this study.
So
the miner is submitting a share to the pool, say every 30 seconds or so. Most of them are valid shares, but you can have invalid shares too. What's an invalid share? Well, it's a share that is too late. So too late meaning like in between the time that the miner sent that share to the pool, another block has already been mined. And so the miner was no longer doing work towards the tip of the chain. So it's like, it's just wasted energy.
From whose perspective? From the mining pool, from their node's perspective?
Yeah.
Okay.
So assuming the pool would receive a block from the network.
Yeah.
It believes it to be the tip of the network. It did advance it one block.
Yeah.
Of course, that can be reorged out. But for the, you know, most of the time, it's true. It doesn't get reorged out. And then the pool then would just throw away that share and not, I mean, the purpose of the shares here is accounting. It's so that the pool knows how to pay out to the miners. Like, because when the pool does win a block or when the pool does a payout, it has to know how much to pay each miner that's connected to that pool. And any of these shares that are stale, it'll throw them away and not count them. So as a miner, that's bad. You want to achieve 100% of your shares to be accepted. So what this graph here is showing is that with Stratum v1 on this benchmark study that was done, and it should be noted this is a simulation that was done, so not the real network. So that should be noted. But I think it's a pretty high quality simulation of reality. And I mean, it's a little hard for us to see, but hopefully the audience can read those numbers better. But bottom line is Stratum v1 has something like 0.1 to 0.2% loss. for these stale shares. When you add in Stratum V2, it drops substantially. Mm-hmm. The losses drop substantially. And then there's two different Stratum V2 options here. One is where the pool still selects the transactions. So for people looking at the display right now, JD stands for job declaration. And that's sort of like who's declaring the block template, who's declaring what the transactions are. So if the pool is, it still is a big win. But if the miner actually selects transactions, it's an even bigger win. Mm. It basically goes to 100% accepted shares. So if you can eliminate 0.2% share loss for a miner that has, say, 10% profit margin, this can be a 2% boost to your profits.
Yeah, wow.
So, I mean, so you can take these like latency numbers and share loss numbers, translate them into real dollars and cents.
Now, high level, how much of this is just because Stratum V2 is more efficient, so you're doing binary instead of JSON, versus how much of the benefit comes if the miner is the one doing the block template selection?
That's the two scenarios. So in this graph, it's the Stratum V2 without job JD.
Okay. Oh, got it.
That's where you're getting the benefit from the wire protocol efficiencies.
Okay.
And then Stratum V2 with JD, that's where the miner itself is selecting transactions. That's when you get both the wire protocol and the miner is selecting the transactions.
That's beautiful, because then the economic incentive for decentralization.
Exactly. So that's what got me really excited about this, because it's not just like an ethos sales argument. Like if you're telling the miner, hey, you got to run your own Bitcoin core node, and then the miner's like, oh, it's more operational hassle for me. And it's like, oh, do it for the ethos. Yeah. It's like, okay. It's like now I can be like, well, no, actually, if you can boost your profitability by like 1.2%.
That's huge.
It's huge. And over time, margins are going to continue to be compressed. And so an extra 1 or 2% profit margin will be enormous. It'll separate the winners from the losers. So if we scroll down... go ahead.
Can I interrupt for a question here? This is a little bit of level setting, or maybe a little bit of a basic type of question, but I just want to clarify for myself and maybe people who are listening. This JD issue is talking about block template selection, right? Like, is block template selected by the pool organizer or by the miner themselves?
So
is that right?
With Stratum V1, it is only... there's only one option, and the pool has to select the transactions, or also known as creating a block template, but it literally means the same thing. With Stratum V2, it creates it's an architecture that creates the flexibility either can be supported. So you can have a Stratum V2 pool that can have many miners connected to it. Some miners can choose to select their own transactions, and other miners choose not to. It can support both.
And just to emphasize how this connects to like the higher level Bitcoin, like the idea of Bitcoin is you want to have censorship resistant transactions. You want nobody to be able to choke the throat of somebody selecting those transactions. And if you have a single pool that is dominant, then maybe US government or somebody could tell them to censor these types of transactions. But the more that those transactions are chosen, those block templates, and hence those transactions are chosen further toward the fringe, at the actual mining point, the less risk you have of like there being a single throat to choke. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. Right now, there's three pools that represent 80 to 90% of the hash rate. That's extreme concentration.
And they're effectively like Chinese pools, right?
Except for Foundry. So, okay. I mean, there's Ant Pool and Friends.
Yeah.
There's F2 Pool, both are Chinese, and then Foundry's American. But we can't just like poke at the Chinese ones.
Sure.
I mean, the American one, the U.S.
There's risks on
the U.S.
front.
Government can easily influence them, right? We want many more entities, and we want them to be geographically distributed.
Definitely.
As Bitcoiners. So, and also the Ant Pool and Friends. We've talked about this before in the show a few months ago, but they're around 40% of the hash rate just themselves. So it's very dangerous and brittle, and not a place we want to be. So it's important to to allow, whereas miners, individual miners themselves, is much more distributed. There's thousands and thousands of miners globally. So enabling them to even be able to select their own transactions is important. Stratum V2 is the software that supports that. You actually need to get miners to adopt it as well. I'm hoping this study and this kind of like financial performance incentive will help motivate that change. It should be noted too, this is not, Stratum V2 is not like a silver bullet. It doesn't solve all problems. It's just a very meaningful step towards improving the situation. But David, you brought up Braidpool, and we probably don't have time to go into a deep dive on Braidpool, but it's more of an R&D project. There's a lot of questions to be answered, whether it's even like technically feasible, but it is more in the silver bullet arena in terms of potentially solving most centralization problems with mining. With Stratum V2, it remains an issue where it's great if the miner themselves can select transactions, but the pool can still see those transactions. So if the pool is feeling pressure from regulators, or if the pool is run by people who are ideologically aligned with abiding by OFAC or censoring the bad guys, the pool could still have that power in the sense of it could just decline working with that miner. It would just reject the shares from that miner. So that's still possible. However, just a couple days ago, Starkware, who worked on a company that works on zero knowledge proof technology, did a really cool demonstration in which they applied zero knowledge proof technology to the shares that are submitted from the miner to the pool. And they were able to prove the fee amount in that share to the pool without actually revealing any of the individual fees. That's very powerful. The next step they need to do is to be able to prove that all of the transactions that were in that block template were valid transactions without having to reveal the transactions to the pool.
Yeah.
If they're able to achieve that, then the miner can prove to the pool, hey, number one, I'm working on I'm working on a valid block with this amount of fees, and is working towards the Coinbase Mr. Pool are going to receive the Bitcoin to prove that they're working towards that pool's Coinbase without revealing any of the transactions. That would be amazing, because then you get excellent censorship resistant.
Yeah.
Because then the pool just has plausible deniability. They're like, we didn't know that they were including this naughty transaction in the block. So hopefully that progresses. And I think they're working on that latter part, the proving the transaction validity. Now, I asked what the performance was for just the first part, and I think it was like took 7 seconds on a computer. The latency numbers we just talked about with this article, we're talking about, milliseconds matter. So 7 seconds, you clearly can't wait around for that, but it can probably be done asynchronously to prove to the pool that these are valid shares. So I think that's quite exciting. Yeah. So people should monitor that. But getting back to this report, let's scroll down, please. I won't go into every graph, but there's several different points of latency that matter. Scroll down. Another one for latency. There's both. Let's keep scrolling down, please. Block change latency. So this is where when a new block is mined, then the pool has to inform the miner that, hey, you need to start mining against this new block.
Yeah.
So that happens on average every 10 minutes. Mm. So the latency there, any kind of latency introduced, means that the miner is still mining on the old block.
Yeah.
And that's bad too. You're literally wasting energy. So the faster you can update it and tell it, the better. Now, if we scroll down to one more, the next graph, please. This would be the job change latency. Same concept, except this is just the pool needs to tell the miner much more frequently than every 10 minutes, start mining on this new job, because it's received new transactions with higher fees. So it has to tell the miner, start mining on this new job. So all of these different points of complexity introduce latency. The more you reduce it, the more money you make as a miner. And Stratum B2 is much more efficient across all these dimensions. Now, the last thing I'll mention...
With JD, it always appears to be even like tremendously more efficient even.
Yeah, because you're doing less information passing.
So across all of these, it's true that the wire protocol efficiencies gain you a lot. And then by running Bitcoin Core locally at the miner, you gain even more on latency improvements.
Awesome.
Which is music to our ears. Now, if we can go to the... Scroll down to the, I think, the last part. I figured there's actually a graph, but the other big potential, actually, we can probably just switch the camera back to us now. I'll just speak to the last part. Thank you. The last big gain is I mentioned that Stratum V1 doesn't have any encryption or authentication. There's no security in the wire protocol. And Matt Corallo, like 6 years ago, demonstrated how easy it is to hijack hash rate.
That's crazy.
So he performed an actual attack against a miner that he was friendly with and said he was going to do this, and stole their hash rate. is like a BGP internet attack, and there's nothing that the miner can really do about that without employing their own solution. Like that, meaning the Stratum protocol itself doesn't defend against that. But Stratum V2 does, because it adds encryption and authentication so that there could be no man in the middle attack. Mm. Now, the problem is, how does anyone know if they're being hijacked? Because if you only hijack a small percentage, like 1% or 2%, is that even detectable? Mm. Can a miner even know that? Mm. Probably not. I've heard from...
Can we clarify hijacking? What does it mean? Does it mean that you're sort of inserting your receive address in the block template to get the Coinbase reward, or
it would be like if you're running ASICs and I'm not, if I'm able to intercept the internet traffic between you and the pool and pose it as myself, then I don't have to run any ASICs, and I basically hijack your ASICs and get the...
And you're inserting like an identifier that's from you that means that the shares of the rewards will go to you.
Yeah. So it's as long as you keep the percentage low enough, it's largely undetectable. My understanding is a lot of miners in the industry think that it could be up to 10% hijacked without detection, which would be insane.
Currently.
Wow.
Now, I mean, meaning it would be hard to detect up to that. Now, I also understand a lot of miners, I think, have implemented their own proprietary solution to try to mitigate this risk. So I'm not suggesting that there's actually 10% or even 1% being hijacked, because I think a lot of miners have created their own proprietary solution.
Right.
But if we spread if you go beyond the huge miners, like a smaller miner or an individual, obviously is not going to have the resources to defend against that. And even the larger ones could still be having it stolen from them, and they don't even know. So it's better just to solve that. Stratum V2 solves that. So a big portion of the profitability increase comes from a swag at what that could be. And actually, it could be a much larger profitability increase if you're getting more stolen from than what the report suggests. The report just assumes 50 basis points, like 0.5% is being stolen. But if it's 2% or 10%, it would literally be like you could double your profits if you ran Stratum V2.
So one big question, and then maybe an idea that comes out of that. The big question is, how difficult is it for an individual miner to be able to select their own block template? So they need to run a full node. Like, what exactly do they need to implement to be able to participate?
One, there needs to be a pool that supports Stratum V2.
Right.
Demand is a new startup that does support Stratum V2. They're just getting going. So they're, my understanding, they're at a point where if you're a miner and you're intrigued by this, you can definitely go test out Demand and get started with Demand. So that's one option. But what we really need to see, we want to see Foundry adopt Stratum V2, Antpool to adopt Stratum V2, Ocean to adopt Stratum V2, and like other pools to adopt it. or even new pools emerge. So that's one thing that needs to be done.
Just to clarify, because I have an idea around that, but specifically, if I'm a miner and I'm currently pointing towards a Stratum V2 pool, assume we have those operating, what do I need to do to be able to get my block to?
And then I'll answer. Yeah. So as a miner, you need to run a Bitcoin implementation, be it Bitcoin Core or an alternative, in order to select transactions. That's if you use Stratum V2 with job declaration. Right. If you want to take a baby step, you can use Stratum V2 without that, and then you don't have any additional operational overload on your part, except for if your ASICs are running Stratum V1 firmware, which they almost certainly are today, then you need a proxy that translates from Stratum V1, the firmware running on your ASICs, to the Stratum V2 protocol. This open source project I mentioned that Spiral and others have contributed to, the acronym is SRI, Stratum Reference Implementation. It includes a proxy. So the software's already written, but you do need to run that proxy, and you need to run it on a computer. It can be as simple as a Raspberry Pi. This doesn't require a beefy computer, but you do need a computer at your mining site. And even if you have like thousands of ASICs, you only need to run one of these at your mining site. So whether you have one ASIC or ASIC rig or thousands, it doesn't matter. You need to run one. You need to run that proxy. So another development that'll occur over time is native Stratum V2 firmware for ASICs. So that would, you know, that would mean Bitmain's developing that for their equipment, MicroBT for their equipment, Block implementing it for their chips. Now, the only Stratum V2 firmware that I'm aware of, Brains has developed Stratum V2 firmware that runs on, I think, both Bitmain and MicroBT hardware. Mm. So again, it's not required to get going. You can use Stratum V1 firmware, but you would need to run this proxy.
Yeah.
If you want to use the job declarator, then you also need to run Bitcoin Core or a Bitcoin implementation at your site as well. So for a lot of miners, that's going to be like, you know, flexing new muscles and learning something new. Another thing that'll help adoption is to have companies provide turnkey solutions. So
exactly.
I would love to see Block or anyone in the space, but like
I was getting to make a startup request for startup right around this.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've certainly communicated this to the proto team, and would love to see any, you know, Bitmain or MicroBT, any of these companies. The ideal solution is the mining rig comes with Stratum V2 firmware and Bitcoin Core running out of the box in that. And you as a miner, you literally just plug it in and it works.
Yeah.
Like you don't have to do anything. So we will definitely get there.
So I love all of that. The sort of startup idea that I have that I would love to see, and it would be easier in that world, but maybe there's like a hack to get going faster, would be, so instead of like starting a new pool to service Stratum V2, I would love to see someone create a creator of pools. Like imagine, and maybe this is a vibe coding project, I could literally just go to like a website, spin up a pool. And I'm just thinking like, imagine all of us had bid access. I don't know if we do or don't, but like, I could just be like, hey guys, this is the Presidio Bitcoin pool. Point at me or like whatever. Like obviously you have to get enough to make the economics work. And if you could take the headache out of that, like in the early days, maybe you run the proxy, maybe you run the Bitcoin core node using something like Lexi and the trusted execution environment for someone. If you could just take all of the headache out and just be like, it's so easy to spin up a pool. I click a button and now I just have to go do the hard work of recruiting my friends or other companies. That to me would be sick.
There was actually a Presidio Bitcoin hackathon project. Did you see this one where it was like an analytics dashboard for management?
Yeah.
Effectively, if you build that out and get a lot of distribution on that, you earn the opportunity to basically do what you're talking about, right?
Yeah. But that'd be cool.
Not to piss on your idea, but let me just walk through some of the challenges of that.
I mean, it's about to piss on my idea.
You've got to piss on your idea.
So I absolutely encourage that, but here are some of the challenges that Presidio Bitcoin pool would have to face. So first of all, just, you know, let's say we clicked a button, started a pool, and actually we absolutely, the SRA project has all the libraries and building blocks to run your own Stratum V2 pool. Mm-hmm. So in fact, that's a good vibe coding project for us. We should try to create our own Stratum V2 pool by vibe coding, clicking a button.
Let's go.
I'm certain that that's trivial.
Yep.
Great. Now we have a pool up and running. Okay. One, how do we get miners to point to it, right? And that's a marketing exercise. That's a reputation and trust exercise. So that's a huge challenge. Right. It's more than just like pressing a button.
Of course, yeah.
That's just traditional like marketing and
business development.
Secondly is economics. So there's different payout mechanisms that pools can provide to miners. I believe we talked about it on the show before. There are a variety of payout mechanisms. I'll keep it very high level and just choose two. Because there's a luck factor with mining, you don't know when you're going to mine a block. You know statistically, well, I have X percentage of the hash rate, so I should mine X percent of the blocks. But let's say that you have 0.1% of the total hash rate, which is a very serious operation. It would cost a lot of money to build out that operation. That means you're mining a block every week or so on average. But you could go months and months and months of bad luck where you don't mine a block. So if you have to pay bills, you could go bankrupt. So that's just a fundamental thing about mining. There's nothing to, you can't fix that. That luck factor is just a reality. So who takes the financial risk? Is it the pool or is it the miner? So that high level question drives a lot of these payout mechanisms. And so the dominant payout mechanism on the network today is FPPS, where the pool takes the risk. And miners love that because they're like, great, the pool takes the risk. I don't take the risk. I like that. So miners like that. It's actually bad for decentralization. And it's what's led to Antpool and Friends. The Friends are small pools that have like 1% or 5% hash rate and don't want to go bankrupt. So they just buddy up, partner with Antpool. Antpool has this massive liquidity to fund any kind of bad luck streak. And because they have a lot higher percentage of the hash rate, they're not going to go months without mining a block. So that's a very centralizing factor. But if we were to spin up Presidio Bitcoin pool, if we're going to support FPPS, we need money. We need financing, else we'd go bankrupt right away. If we use PPLNS, which is a payout mechanism where the miners take the risk, that's definitely better for decentralization, certainly better for our little pool because we don't face financial risk. Because with PPLNS, we only pay miners who are on our pool when we actually mine a block.
Yeah.
How are we going to, why are miners going to sign up for us though?
Well, so I want to be clear. I mean, these are all very good points. And like, I certainly am not suggesting that like the Presidio Bitcoin pool would actually be like the profitable pool to run. I think my broader point is the easier you make it to experiment with this stuff, the more you can have. So it's going to look like a toy at first. So why would we point as Presidio Bitcoin pool? Because it's fun. And we're already seeing people on Nostr like form their own little mini pools. And like, you know, we're seeing experimentation where it's like, you know, instead of just sort of levelized payout, it's like, okay, maybe it's like you still have some lottery. So if you actually hit the thing, you get whatever, 50% of the block, and then you get like smoothing. So my broader point is you're going to see a lot of people experiment with all kinds of new payout models just because it's easy and it's fun. And like people will do it just for the lulls to get started. But then over time, what I think you could see happen here is, you know, to your point, it becomes like you get more decentralization because the businesses that succeed are those with the best relationships. So I'm just thinking as an example, thinking out loud, nothing proprietary here. I've never discussed this with them, but like a company like Satoshi Energy, right? Like they have all this proprietary, the energy providers that they work with and the miners. What if they were able to come up and just like, hey, we're going to spin up a pool. You know, you could easily do the math to figure out like what's the minimum amount of hash rate you would need to make this like pencil out. But maybe there's like some kicker. It's like, you know, we give you a discount to join our pool because you also let us negotiate the energy contract from the back end. We make a lot of cash on that. So my broader point is just like, if you can bring it down to so simple that anyone could start it, you're going to see a lot more business model innovation that's like more serious too.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yep. That's exciting. Go ahead, David.
I'd like to understand a little bit about the decision-making and the risk in Stratum V2 and kind of the traditional ecosystem. Because I think these new ecosystems like Max is proposing, I think they probably ultimately work best with actors who are not so economically focused. Like they have a lot more ideology associate with them, or they're just hobbyists where they're not like trying to do the numbers and make their bills work out. But in the kind of traditional ecosystems, you know, from the large pools, is it true that the pool operator needs to adopt Stratum V2, but and the miners have to adopt it, right? So presumably, since it's a protocol and involves communication, both parties have to participate. But do most or all of the benefits go to the miners, or do the pools also get some benefit from implementing it?
So, well, and there's two types of pools that could adopt it, right? Existing incumbents or new ones. So if you're a startup, you're incentivized to do it like demand, because this is your differentiator, right? And you want to go from zero to a much higher hash rate. So the incentive there, I think, is pretty clear. But what if you're Foundry or Ant Pool or one of the large pools? What's their incentive? One incentive can be reduce regulatory pressure, right? Because if you have a very large hash rate and you've got regulators knocking on your door to do OFAC censorship or other type of censorship, you're likely in a better situation if you can just be like, I have no control over that. Sorry. Right. So if you're not selecting the transactions and other people are, you can just be like, go talk to them. Go talk to these other guys. They're the ones selecting transactions. So that can be one incentive. A second one potentially is like, I believe the pools that have a large percentage hash rate do get uncomfortable when it's approaching 50%, because they know what that sort of means for Bitcoin. They don't really want to be over 50% hash rate. This is more speculation, but or hearsay, but I think that's true. So being able to reduce that while still benefiting economically by being the payout pool can make a lot of sense for them. And so to me, it seems to make a lot of sense, whether you're an AMP pool or Foundry of the world, that you retain being the payout pool for a large percent of the hash rate, but you're not selecting the transactions for that same amount of hash rate.
And is there any, like, I'm just imagining sort of how, I feel like the hard part of this then is to sell Stratum V2 to those pool operators instead of to the miners. I mean, the miners probably need some convincing, but probably the pool operators are really, it's quite critical to get them on board, because if they are not on board, it doesn't work. So I wonder, is there a way to do some transitional onboarding where you can do some of your, maybe 99% of your hashing still with SV1 and, you know, 1% with SV2 and sort of titrate the mix as you get more comfortable with it, or as your customers adopt it?
You can spin up a separate pool and do that transition, sure. So it's not like you have to switch everyone over at once. Some of these pools run their own miners too, just for like testing purposes or business purposes or whatever. So, you know, something they could do is test out with their own hash rate first. I'm not sure I agree though that it's going to be harder to sell pools and miners. Each actor has their own challenges selling to them, but I mean, I have a lot of conversations with all these pools and a lot of miners, and I'd say right now we're ahead of the game on pools and behind on miners. So,
oh, good.
Good, but we need both. Right? In fact, I think miners are more important, because we only need one quality pool.
Yeah, the miners will point.
Right. That the miners can point to. Now, a healthier system is when there's many pools, because if there's one pool, that's dangerous as well. But to get going, we only need one pool. And then any miner who wants to be an early adopter, gain the 77% profitability or whatever, can point to that pool. So we only need one pool. I think selling to the miners and finding miner early adopters is the most important thing.
But with this kind of report, I know it's a little bit of a simulation, but like this kind of thing should be pretty convincing, right? Because my understanding with miners, because they're very kind of, in a sense, coin operated, they have to be very efficient about how they operate their business and how they, like, there's almost no ideology to a at-scale miner, right? They're more focused on the economics. They have to make sense.
It's free markets on steroids.
Correct.
Yeah, right.
Which is why I was excited to bring this report to the show and talk about it, because I do think it's a really important sales tool. It's a new twist to the sales tool. It's more from like ethos or like engineering, like, oh, security is good, to like, oh, this translates to your bottom line. It makes me think of one more thing that I didn't cover in that study, but there was another component there around fees. And the faster that the block template that has all the proposed transactions can update to reflect the highest paying fees, the better. Because you want the highest paying fees in a block, right? So the faster you can turn that around, the lower the latency there, you're going to generate more revenue.
That's a good point.
And now historically, it's been lost in the noise, because 99% of mining revenue comes from the block subsidy, the minting of new Bitcoin, and not fees. But as we all know, the block subsidy goes to zero, and then all that's left is fees. And so, you know, every 4 years, every halving, fees become more and more important. And so as fees become more and more important to Bitcoin, any small financial performance difference you can make and latency around the fees, it's going to become more meaningful for miners. So just be aware of that dynamic changing over time too. So something in the past that everyone just like rolls their eyes at, or it's like it's inconsequential, all of a sudden becomes quite meaningful. And these latency improvements with Stratum V2 absolutely matter for that as well. A slight tangent to that, I've mentioned the FPPS payout mechanism. It gets more and more financial risky over time, because FPPS pays out a guaranteed amount to miners every day, covering both the block subsidy and the fees. Obviously, you already know what the block subsidy is ahead of time. That's predictable. You have no idea what the fees are until the blocks actually get mined. So what's typical is that a pool will look at the past 24 hours or some time period, typically 24 hours, and be like, well, here's the total amount in fees. And so that then they use that to derive how much they pay out to the miners. That's highly variable every day. And
what's the high-low split on that today? Like
between
Coinbase Reward versus transaction fees? Is it like in the highest fee environments, what does it look like? And in the lowest fee environments, what does it look like? Just to get a sense of.
I mean, right now the mempool is almost empty. So the transaction fees are minuscule. So it's like less than 1%, I'm sure. In high fees, like a year ago during the halving, like the extreme crazy high fees when like runes were being minted or whatever.
It was like half, no?
It was like substantial.
Yeah, it was a lot.
Or more, or it was like even more than the Coinbase. I mean, it was substantial. So there's a big range, but in general, it's pretty low. But it obviously goes up. It gets to 100% eventually. We don't know what the absolute number is going to be, but it definitely goes to 100%. And you know, I think Bitcoin's not an interesting experiment if it doesn't pick up demand for transactions and fees. Otherwise, it's just a ETF database and not really an interesting project.
I think that's what some people are scared of right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's legitimate scare. It's a long-term scare. I'm not worried about it in the short term, but like, you know, for many years, we've been talking about, well, we need to see demand, we need to see fees increase, and, you know, we're still not seeing that. The only time we see fees increase is like, you know, tokens and shitcoin stuff. You know, spam on the blockchain. So in any case,
you're like, use Bitcoin, but not that way.
Yeah, exactly.
But I wanted to point out that FPPS gets even riskier over time with these highly variable fees. And it just increases the chance of pools going bankrupt. So I think FPPS as a centralization force is very nasty and one of the bigger risks to Bitcoin. I also happen to think it naturally resolves itself because pools will go bankrupt, but that would be very, very bad and disruptive. So hopefully it gets resolved through technology like a Braid Pool project, which we didn't go into detail in the show. I think we talked about it in another show.
We can talk about it again
sometime too, but let's just keep it as like a benefit. If Braid Pool works technically, then the short TLDR, if it works technically, instead of waiting every 10 minutes for a block to be produced, this Braid Pool separate blockchain could be as fast as like every 100 milliseconds. So you're reducing variance because every 100 milliseconds, a miner could get shares they could sell on an open market. And so instead of having to wait, I mean, you basically reduce it by like three orders of magnitude, this variance. So what I was complaining about before about like, oh, you might have to go months without getting paid. So of course you're not going to solo mine. You got to team up with others. Well, if those months shrink to like hours, well, then lots of people can solo mine.
Yeah.
So that would be the beauty of the Braid Pool. And then, so if it does work, literally pools don't need to exist. Every miner would run Braid Pool software, and every miner is a quote pool, and there just really is no pools.
And you could get streamed via Lightning, right? Like real time.
And another, like second. I mentioned the Amp Pool and Friends, and they're a centralization point, and like these other pools have partnered with the Amp Pool because of these economic challenges. Well, so they partner with Amp Pool because that's the one entity, or there's like one or two entities who would are even big enough to do that. But with Braid Pool, it could be a global free market. You could sell this to any financial investor in the world.
Yeah.
So anyone who wants this type of exposure could buy these shares literally every 100 milliseconds. So it's very attractive.
So, okay, that opens so many questions. I know we're running out of time, but like, it's been a while since I've looked at the state of like, so if you think about the way, so taking a giant step back, a lot of the stuff that you're talking about is effectively, you know, using financial markets to smooth uncertainty.
Yeah.
That's why the CME exists. That's why futures and derivatives markets exist for things back in the day, like corn, trying to hedge for like, what's the weather going to be like? And if you look forward to the future, you can clearly see there's going to be the CME or something like there's going to be all of these different products and derivatives and investment banks or whatever that specialize in like servicing miners. When I last looked at this a couple of years ago, one, there was very little of that. Like, it's still impossible for a miner to even get a letter of credit to say, like, we're not going to go bankrupt if we, whatever, or the offtaker for energy. And there still wasn't really like a hash rate derivatives marketplaces, or you still weren't even like able to sell hash rate. Think, what's his name? Ethan and those guys at Luxor and some others maybe have done that since then. What is the state of things like hash rate marketplaces, just like banks being willing to even like offer any of these products to miners? Are we still in the dark ages or have we started to come out?
Yeah, I'm not really deep on that. So don't know.
Future episode.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of us will have to learn. I don't really know. I mean, obviously it makes sense conceptually.
Yeah.
So I'm a little surprised it's not popular. Or maybe it is popular and we don't know, but like,
yeah, if there's a listener in the chat that can educate us, please do.
So yeah, I'm just not sure.
Yeah. Anyways, a lot of opportunity. Like what's so exciting to me is if you zoom out the 20,000 foot view, like if you really believe that everything is going to go on top of Bitcoin, the entire economy is going to get rebuilt on Bitcoin, man, there's so much opportunity left. Like all of traditional financial markets are going to have to get rebuilt Bitcoin native. And like, man, to your point, DK, a couple of months ago, it's like, whenever it's like, oh shit, I missed Bitcoin. It's, you know, it's too late. It's like, no, we haven't even started.
Yeah. Now you can vibe, goat your dream up. I think, I know we're far past, we got started a little bit late. Now we're far past the end time, but I did want to hear, you know, one final comment. Cause I think Steve, you had some crazy billboard idea that you were going to share, and I didn't.
Well, I want us to discuss it. So I'll plant the seed now, so that the audience, if they have ideas, and then we can jam next week on it too. But I was chatting with some folks about like, hey, how do we spread the word about Bitcoin as everyday money, and like, you know, a traditional way to spread the word is on physical billboards, right? In fact, quick question. We funded a Noster billboard.
Yeah.
I paid for like half of it. What's the status of that? Is there a Noster billboard?
So there was. I was not super close to that. I was also a major contributor on this one. They had it up in Sao Paulo for 2 weeks.
Is there a Can I at least get a picture of it?
Yeah, no, I shared it in the chat.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. Shared in the chat. Yeah.
Oh my God, I missed it. Okay.
It's in Portuguese though, so watch out.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, well, so
you can vibe with the solution.
So someone is suggesting, okay, let's do billboards in many cities around the world, you know, with headlines that are provocative or at least conjure up the notion of like Bitcoin is everyday money. Because like, I think most of the world has no idea what the status of Bitcoin is. And then Bitcoiners, the dominant narrative is number go up, digital gold, Bitcoin treasury companies, and only a very niche portion of the world, like our show and the three of us and Prodigy of Bitcoin, are talking about Bitcoin as everyday money. So just create awareness. So there's that concept. Separately, we talk about vibe-coded apps all the time. So I'm wondering, I mean, I see the value in a billboard campaign purely for awareness generation, just planting a seed, changing people's mind. But it would be so much more powerful if it was somehow combined with something actionable and fun and social. So is there, I have no concrete idea, but is there a way to connect apps that have Bitcoin payments to these billboards? Is there a way to actually make this so that anyone in the world, like anyone in the world we've already shown can be a builder now because they can vibe code. So anyone seeing these billboards could vibe code an app. So is there a way to encourage people to vibe code an app that has Bitcoin payments and then it gets used or via these billboards? Like there's a QR code or something on the billboard where someone downloads something and connects that. So it creates this incentive to like, oh, I want to vibe code an app because I know that millions of people around the world might see it and use it. And obviously there needs to be some kind of like filter or, you know, quality mechanism. Only the best ones rise to the top. But so I wanted to jam on that. See if you guys are like better at real-time idea generation. So maybe next week we can talk about that. Anyone listening now, if you have ideas, give a shout out.
Maybe there's a pyramid style payout, which could BitConnect it. That's a joke. That's a deep cut. I love that. We should definitely talk more about it.
We're definitely trying to avoid scams.
It's a joke. One thing I did want to mention, though, briefly before we hop off, because it's very much ties in this Bitcoin as everyday money, is a really cool experience I had yesterday. So we'll bring it full circle. I started by saying I orange-pilled two people yesterday. I told you about the first one. It's coming to Builder. The second one I'm even more excited about. So long story, but I'm starting to my hands a little bit of planting and permaculture, which is its own interesting rabbit hole. And as part of that, the guy who helped me get set up turns out is an incredible, honey dealer. He makes his own honey. And so he's my new honey dealer. And, you know, I could have paid him with cash. That's cool. You know, fine. But I was just like, yo, any chance you would want to take some Bitcoin instead? And he was like, Bitcoin? Huh. Isn't that thing that went way up? I'm like, yeah, it is. It could go way down tomorrow, but if you hold it for a long time, maybe it's interesting. And I, you know, I kind of like couched to him in the terms of if you get a little bit, you know, don't sell it. You're going to want to read more. And the more you read, the more you'll either realize this is awesome and it's totally for me or no, this is totally not for me. Obviously, I think we all know which way we think it's going to go, but whatever, it can go whichever way it was. But it was so gratifying. He got super excited. Now, two things I want to comment on. One, it was a giant pain in the ass still in 2025 to figure out, no coiner, how do I get this person some Bitcoin? My first thought, get them on Cash App. And I did. And then, I mean, love Cash App. I get it, regulated financial institutions. Then it's like, fuck, I don't have my like bank account info or driver's license, all this KYC stuff. And I was like, yeah, I know, it's a giant pain. Okay, you can do it when you get home and I'll send it. But then I wanted that magic moment of sending it to him right there on the spot. So I still think, interestingly, and I realize now I probably could have sent him the river gifting function, so I should have thought of that. But
I tried that and have had similar problems.
It's tough. So there's still like, not a good way to get this dude some Bitcoin easily. So what I had him do was I did have him download, and I know there's like criticisms of this, but I still think it's like the best normie wallet is Moon Wallet, M-U-U-N wallet. So I have him download Moon. I'm not an investor or anything in Moon either. Like I just think it works. And especially in a low fee environment, who cares about the swaps? And so I have him create the Moon thing and I'm like, this is going to be so complicated because now we have to discuss a seed phrase and all this crap. But he loved it. Now, granted, he's like a DIY guy, but he was like, no, I want to write this down. And like the man, he was like, oh, this is my first experience. This is real Bitcoin with the seed phrase. I was like, Yeah. Okay.
Great.
And anyways, long story short, it was a cool experience. The second thing he noticed is he was like looking at it. He was like, yo, like, so this is like this amount in USD. I was like, yeah. And he was like, but Bitcoin's worth so much. How many do I actually have? And I explained to him, I was like, well, that depends. You could have a few thousand Satoshis here. Or how would you feel if this was just a few thousand Bitcoins? He's like, well, what do you mean? I was like, well, it's just one network, so we could just move the decimal place. And I will say, I think we could have gotten it to work either way. But when I told him, imagine you now, just, you own a few thousand Bitcoins, his eyes lit up. He's like, I have a few thousand Bitcoins. I'm like, yeah, why not? And he was like, that's so cool. I can't wait to tell everyone. I was like, that's awesome.
That's clearly the future.
So it was very cool. And now I'm going to be able to buy honey from Bitcoin. And this guy is like, he was super stoked on it. So that was cool.
That's great. I have more to say about that, but we are way over.
We're way over. Spread the word.
Okay. We'll call it at that. Spread the word. Bitcoin is Bitcoin.
Bitcoin is Bitcoin.
And we'll catch you next week.
See you next week.
All right. Bye. See ya. Bye-bye.
Yeah.